This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Hey, film fans, welcome along to another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Long time no hear, speak. That is if you joined us for our extra episode on Friday, where we had a bit of a Fall Guy special. It was wonderful to have David Leitch and Kelly McCormick back on the podcast, as well as my very dear and talented friend, Mr. Drew Pearce. Drewisms, I think, should be a phrase that most people should coin from this point onward. Anyway, I hope you've had the joy and the time to go and experience Fall Guy and laugh your pants off like I did. If not, it's out in cinemas now, as is the subject of this episode. Now, we've got another one of our live shows for you today, recorded a couple of weeks ago at Everyman Borough Yard with the wonderful Rose Glass. She's the director and co-writer of Love Lies Bleeding. Rose is quite a new filmmaker in that this is only her second film. Her previous film, Saint Maud, we waxed lyrical about on this show. We had star of the film, Morvith Clark, and we also had the composer, which was just the most brilliant opportunity to celebrate a brand new filmmaker. Rose has excelled herself with her new film. It's called Love Lies Bleeding, as I said, and it's out in cinemas now. It stars Kristen Stewart, Katie O'Brien, Jenna Malone, Dave Franco and Ed Harris. And the kind of top line plot of the film is, follows the relationship between a reclusive gym manager who is part of a crime family and an ambitious bodybuilder in 1989 small town America. That's kind of all you really need to know, to be honest, before going into this film, because you just need to allow yourself to experience this phenomenal film that is many parts of many things, but I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. And Love Lies Bleeding is scored by friend of the show, the wonderful Clint Mansell, who has done something extraordinary once again with how he is helped tell the story through the power of music. So we'll begin with his title track.
Thank you for having me.
Is it nice to step in the room once the film's just played? Do you kind of feel an energy or a kind of feeling from an audience or vibe or smell them?
That's nice. It smells good.
Let's talk a little bit about the film before we dive into the music then. I mean, what was the kind of catalyst for this story, really, in terms of where did it start for you, the journey with Love Lies Bleeding?
I think it's an idea that I sort of started having the kernel of just when I was in post-production for St. Maud, which is basically just thinking, oh, wouldn't it be cool to tell a story about a really muscly woman who wants to be a bodybuilder? And probably also because St. Maud was this very like sort of introverted, uptight, kind of repressed sort of story, maybe also something to do with, you know, I think by the time me and Veronica, my co-writer, by the time we started writing this, it was sort of lockdown as well. There was a lot of very kind of pent up, repressed kind of energy, which felt it needed to go somewhere. So it was like, ended up having an urge to do something quite bombastic and pulpy and more extrovert.
And was that a different experience writing with someone as well, you know, in terms of that?
Yes, it was a lot more enjoyable. I'd never done it before, like never co-written. And I think anyone who's like tried to get their first film off the ground writing by yourself, it's very kind of insular, isolating, very anxiety-inducing process. And I was determined to kind of make something fun and have fun making it. And Veronica, someone who I've been really good friends with for years, she's a writer-director as well. She just was the lead director on Baby Reindeer, which everyone's
amazing.
Loving at the moment.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, I came to her with this like very kind of embryonic version of the idea, like, oh, something like this kind of world. And then her and me just kind of locked ourselves in an office for a long time and figured the whole story out, and it just kept kind of growing and expanding into this strange, monstrous kind of thing.
How far away from that original kind of seed, though, of you know, kind of thrown idea at her that you both worked on, was what ended up on screen?
I guess to be honest, I think probably just because what I came to her with originally was kind of quite a basic sort of starting point. So it's definitely expanded a lot from there. And, you know, just I think like in the very beginning, probably the thing I came to her with was a little bit closer to the vibe of and scale of St. Maud. And it was a bit more just focused on this kind of bodybuilder character. I think there was another woman, but I think it maybe wasn't a romance. It was a lot more like one-handery. I think also it was set in, I think when I first went to her, it was like set in Soho in the 60s in London. And then we tried thinking of, oh, maybe it'll be in Scotland in the 90s. And then, you know, that kind of all jumped around a lot. But I sort of knew from the beginning it should be kind of a bit pulpy and violent.
The casting is phenomenal. I mean, across the board as well. Dave Franco is just, it's like, God, that's...
Oh, he's delightful, isn't he? He's
delightful great. Character. But Kristen and Katie, you know, just a fantastic pairing. But did you write it with either of them in mind, you know, with Kristen in mind, particularly for that character of Lou?
Yeah, Kristen was the person who I'd sort of been picturing in that role from the very beginning. I think once we transplanted it from Scotland to America. And I think probably a lot of the time when you're writing stuff, you often go through the exercise of like imagining who the sort of fantasy casting would be, because that's often helpful. So she was that, but obviously I didn't know if she'd do it or not. And then, so she was the first person we sent the script to. She'd seen St. Maud and enjoyed it. So she said yes. So that was sort of incredibly fortuitously smooth a process.
That's amazing. That must be a great feeling to kind
of... Oh, really? Great. So I thought our first meeting went terribly, because I met her in a hotel lobby when she was over here promoting Spencer, and it had all been arranged a bit last minute. And I kind of was a bit kind of blasé and like, oh, this will be fine. You know, she's just a person, whatever. And then found myself like really sort of embarrassingly starstruck when I met her, and kind of really, and I didn't realize she was like, she'd been up celebrating with the cast and crew all night and was like really hungover. And I think a bit kind of like, And I suddenly got really nervous and was just mumbling at her really incoherently. I was like, oh, I really fucked that up. And then, then she read the script and was very lovely and got on great.
Was it a case as well of an idea of writing her in for that character specifically? And then when you get the opportunity to shoot that, of what she then brings to that character, was that kind of a surprise element in terms of, you know, how invested was she in this character in terms of what she brought to her?
Yeah, I guess the sort of like generosity and enthusiasm that she approached the whole thing with definitely sort of very pleasantly surprised me. And I think also just particularly how funny she is. Like, I'd always sort of wanted the film to be funny and like sort of saw it as kind of a dark comedy. But I don't know if that's necessarily particularly what she's known for. But she, I just think she's fantastic in it. I just thought it'd be an incredibly enjoyable role to watch her in.
Was it easy to find then the Katie opposite Lou, or was that journey?
No, that was really difficult. And I think I'd sort of naively gone into it being like, oh, it's gonna, you know, it'll be easy to find a bodybuilder who's a really good actor. And then turned out not to be. And I think because there'd obviously been a bit of pressure in the beginning of, ooh, maybe try offering it to ex well-known actress and maybe we get them a trainer and they'll train for a few months and that'll be fine. Mm. But I think that was the whole thing about having a character that was a bodybuilder that appealed to me. You know, there is something really undeniable. There's no shortcut to looking like that. But we basically saw like hundreds of people basically got so many tapes sent in from some actors, a lot of people who hadn't really acted before, but had this like sporting background of either being bodybuilders or wrestlers or boxers or weightlifters. But basically it was proving very difficult to find someone who had that physicality and was also a really good actor who could like hold their own against Kristen. And it's like a two-hander. Anyway, so we were freaking out a bit, and it was sort of like I was out in Albuquerque in 2022 and we were sort of prepping the film. I cast all of the other roles, and literally like the shoot date's just like looming close, and we didn't have that role. And then fortunately our casting directors then sort of literally put out a Twitter thing, casting call, and Katie, a fan of hers, sent it to her, and she just like tweeted a picture of herself flexing, being like, I'm free. And you're kind of like, oh, thank God. And in a way it was kind of like, why didn't we find her before? She's perfect. You know, she is an actor who also happens to have been a bodybuilder before, and, you know, has been like a martial artist her whole life and sort of does bodybuilding workouts for fun. So, you know, she already had a lifetime work of like all this physical training and was a really good actor. But anyway, from the point where we cast her until the shoot, it was like 2 weeks. So it was literally just kind of like, ah, oh, it's really stressful. But all worked out fine.
Yeah, I mean, their chemistry is extraordinary. And also, and she's just, you can't take your eyes off her, really. So she's just kind of captivating. And I think that that's almost part of the whole thing. You're almost kind of seeing her through Lou's eyes almost, in a way. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think they're both very twinkly and charming and kind of like, oh.
Yeah, that. Absolutely. When you're writing, do you write music into the script? Are you thinking about what it's going to sound like, both in terms of if you're going to have needle drops in there or whether you're going to use score or, yeah, how much do you write?
I mean, I knew there would be a lot of music in it. It just sort of felt like the kind of film which should have a kind of jukeboxy kind of feel to it. But I didn't have a lot of the particular tracks picked out. And yet, but it was something that I sort of wanted to try and get a handle on quite early on, because basically I was like, I know music's going to be important in this. I don't quite know what that music is just yet. So actually, like, I think even once we were in prep, I teamed up with like this guy called Yeet Bulbul, who's like our music consultant on the film. He's basically a musician and a DJ, kind of like musical encyclopedia kind of guy who I'd known for a long time. And I got him to kind of like read some early-ish drafts of the script, and I was sort of slightly stuck between the thing of being like, I know that I feel like there needs to be a lot of music in this film, but I'm not necessarily, you know, it's set in the 80s, obviously. But to be honest, like the 80s isn't like necessarily a decade which maybe personally gets me the most excited musically, or it kind of feels like one that's just been like done a lot in films, you know, same with some of the like, you know, the aesthetics and stuff. So that was one of the fun challenges in general, was like trying to find a way to make it feel like a very convincing film of that era, but sort of make it feel sort of fresh somehow.
The needle drops particularly, they don't feel kind of heavy period pieces in a way, do you know what I mean, in terms of, so they're not dating the film through the music in a way as well. And I think that's kind of a conscious thing, I guess, but it's a fine line to kind of try and tread in a way, I guess, as well.
All the music in there is from the 80s, like that was the thing we sort of ended up with. It was kind of finding a way of basically, you know, filling it with music from the 80s, but it not being the most familiar kind of stuff. And one of the first things you did was kind of like, he was basically like, well, let's, you know, we looked particularly at the character of Lou, Kristen's character, and we're kind of like, maybe let's, she seems like someone who'd maybe sort of like kind of take pride in her music taste and for whom music might be quite important. Maybe let's figure out her music taste and then kind of build the sort of music of the film out from there, the commercial music anyway. So that's what, I don't know, we kind of figured, you know, she's a gay woman in a small town in America, but who basically just kind of thinks, I think, you know, she feels a bit like an outsider, kind of hates the town she grew up in. And we sort of thought that maybe she's, you know, music's kind of an escape for her, in that she's maybe sort of fantasizes about being able to experience different kinds of scenes, I guess, probably just reading bits in magazines from like, you know, more like artsy, interesting kind of stuff going on in like New York and Europe. And maybe, you know, like record collecting and stuff is her kind of outlet for that. So that's how we kind of ended up having a lot more artists in there, like slightly more left field kind of stuff, like sort of Throbbing Gristle and like Martin Rev. And so a lot of those kind of things became, we ended up with a lot of playlists. And then even when we went out to do the shoot, I got him to kind of do playlists for like Kristen and Katie of the stuff their characters might be listening to. And then, so even when we started the edit, we had like a lot of music that we'd kind of curated, which we even kind of treated a little bit like score. I don't know, there's like a lot of stuff from like Patrick Cowley and this Japanese musician called Shiho Ibuki, which is all this weird kind of twinkly synthy sci-fi sort of stuff.
Thank you. even in the gym though as well, before we get into Clint, like that kind of, you know, environment of the gym and what's playing in there, and you know, those choices in there, lose choices, you know, in terms
of just casually kind of playing some Nonna Hendrix
in that place. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of what I really love about.
Yeah, like the first, like the opening of the film, it's this track by Howell Grotzkopf, who's this like German electronic artist from the 80s, which actually then Clint sort of like then sort of wrote stuff which kind of goes on top of that. So that's a nice sort of marriage. But yeah, I like the idea that basically Lou's sort of there sort of playing all this like random obscure European electronic or no wave kind of stuff. And like, yeah, you guys don't understand.
A little bit about Clint and working with him and why he was the right man to complement the music that you had already had in your mind, as well as the story and the characters.
We had like a lot of music already in the film. I think it's like sort of almost like half and half commercial stuff score, and a lot of it's the kind music we had already was a lot of this kind of slightly more weird, sexy, twinkly, synthy tracks. I don't know, but it still felt like the film was somewhat lacking a kind of like real, I don't know, we needed something with a bit more oomph to kind of pull it all together. And basically, and then it's like, so when we were looking for a composer, I think basically it was like, well, I'd love to work with Clint Mansell. Like, that would be great. because like, I'd obviously like, been a fan of him for ages. And I think it was like one of the first films he did, but one of the first films that really made me like, oh, I really want to make films as well, was Darren Aronofsky's first film, Pi, which he did the score to. So anyway, so that was kind of like a nerdy kind of wish fulfillment sort of thing. But I think by the time we approached him, we were like halfway through the edit and we'd just gone back to Albuquerque to do like 5 days pickups, which was mostly like shooting little extra new bits and pieces. So the first version of it that he saw was before we'd done that. So it had all the, it was like a sort of slightly Frankenstein-y cut, which had sort of some storyboard bits in it as well, which he still seemed to be pretty excited by. Anyway, I don't know, we got him on board and he basically was sort of like, I feel like, you know, musically it kind of needs a bit more of like an engine, which is what he gave us. And it kind of really, I don't know, I feel like there's a fun balance between his stuff and the sync stuff. It's kind of like I think he ended up providing this really like sort of pulsing, throbbing kind of spine. And there's a lot of the more kind of like weirdo textural stuff from the sync music dancing around it. He came on board, it was like late-ish in post, and so there's always, you know, like time pressure and this and that, but it's great because like he sort of did a first pass, which is really good. But I feel like I was sort of saying to him, I think I said to him, like, I feel like you're sort of being a little bit too sort of sensible, and in a way, like, it was sort of like, I was like, you know, embrace your inner camp or your inner kind of like playfulness. He's like, oh, I'm not sure about I'm not sure how naturally that comes. anyway, you know, it was just a really fun back yeah. and forth, basically. Like, he's based now in LA and I was in London, so it was a lot of Zooms and stuff. No, it was incredible to get to work with him.
But it is that kind of thing where there's the lovely kind of synergy, like you say, between a lot of the cues and what he's done on that side of it. But then you have these lovely kind of almost piano melodies as well that are kind of, are there as well that kind of...
Yeah, I think particularly some of that, like there's a couple of sort of reoccurring motifs, like I think when Jackie wakes up under the bridge, that kind of like motif then sort of like comes again when Lou and Jackie sort of reunite on the tennis court. So it's kind of like, he's like a big softie really, you know, he's kind of got a lot of these quite sort of tender moments. I mean, aside from that piano, I think a lot of the instrumentation he uses, he was saying he was kind of inspired by, or it was a useful kind of launching off point, at least some of the tracks we had in there already, like the Patrick Cowley stuff and all these synthy kind of things. So he's sort of, or like the Harold Grotzkopf, like that opening track, yeah. which, like I said, he's sort of basically built on that and kind of layered something over it. So I don't know. Yeah, it was a nice sort of symbiotic relationship between his stuff and the sync tracks.
Kind of weird thing where you're kind of using stuff in the edit and then suddenly you can't get clearance for it, and or it costs like £9 million
yeah.
for like 10 seconds or something.
Well, we were like, because yeah, basically by the time we got to the edit and teamed up with our music supervisor Simon Astle, I think, you know, by that point I sort of like had found all this music with Yeet that I really like wanted, and it was kind of like, can we get all this? He was kind of like, okay, let me see, and kind of did manage to pretty much get everything we wanted. I think there was a Grace Jones track originally in the montage of this track Warm Leatherette, which I think we couldn't get. I can't remember if it was too much, if it was just couldn't clear it. But then in the end, but then Simon basically went through all these kind of like playlists we'd come up with and found the Gina X track, which was initially something Yeet had suggested for the bodybuilding competition. So that's the one that's used in the montage Nice Mover, which I love. And originally, I'd really had my heart set on this Dolly Parton track for the closing credits called Love Is Like a Butterfly.
Yeah.
Which I urge everyone to listen to. It's one of my favourites. But apparently, she's like notoriously impossible to get her stuff in films, apparently.
With the ending.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, I love the film. I just think it's like, you know, you're just such a, you're such a brave, not brave is a shitty word to use, but like, but, but you're just, you're, what's the right word? There's an excitement in watching your films because they surprise, they entertain, they just do so much. They're not predictable in any way, shape or form. And that is such a unique thing to experience at the cinema. Do you give yourself boundaries or do you give yourself limitations in any way, shape or form? Because it doesn't feel like you do. And I think that that's a great thing that should be encouraged.
Yeah, no, not really. I think it's like if it feels like it's earned its place in the story, mm-hmm. if it serves the story and it's entertaining, it's interesting, then yeah, absolutely. I think it's, I'd say particularly like me and my editor, I think are sort of like fairly ruthless about sort of, does this really add something? And if it's not, like, we're fairly ruthless about cutting stuff we feel doesn't work. But equally when I was writing it, I think as well with Veronica, we were quite picky. But I don't know, stuff like the ending. To be fair, actually, I think we did initially write a thing where they turn into giants because that just felt like the natural thing to do. And then quite early on, me and Vera were sort of like, oh, maybe we're not, maybe that's too much. Maybe we can't get away. We're not allowed to do that. So we tried taking it out and wrote a few versions of the scene where essentially the same sort of stuff happens, you know, sort of emotionally, logically, but just kept it very grounded. And it always just felt a little bit like a cop-out. And we both like, oh, I really miss Giant Jackie. I really think we should bring her back. And then obviously then I was there like actually shooting it like, fuck, how do we do this?
How did you do it?
Oh, green screen. And then, you know, it wasn't, I think anyone who'd actually done any of that kind of stuff before, it was probably quite straightforward. Like you just sort of shoot, you know, obviously the wide stuff when you're there on the location with Kristen and Ed kind of reacting to all these like tennis balls on, you know, we sort of like positioned all these stands with tennis balls sort of charting where Giant Jackie was in. Cause I don't think you see it in the finished film, but there was like a wide shot where you saw her like coming around the corner and like running down towards them. So all these great shots of Ed Harris kind of like, whoa. And they're like, okay, now she's picking you up, Ed. And kind of thing. And then we filmed Katie against gray screen. So that was kind of new for me and great fun to sort of play around doing that sort of thing. Yeah.
Did you deliberately reunite Ed Harris and Jenna Malone from Stepmom?
No, I'd not seen Stepmom. And then actually I started watching it on the plane, I think, when I was going over to do the pickup shoot. And I was like, oh, fuck, when I was there in the same film together. Yeah, so I just never mentioned that to them.
I've got to mention the costumes as well, because I think they kind of, your hair and makeup department and your costume department are extraordinary. And looked like they were just having the best time ever. How much did you encourage the cast to kind of be involved and collaborate on their characters?
On the looks.
And yeah.
I mean, like we'd written, I think that particularly with Lou and Jackie's character, there was a fair amount of specificity already in the script about how they'd look and like their hairstyle sort of thing. But then, yeah, they both, you know, they both get whisked off for the day with Olga Miller, costume designer, and sort of like, you know, I'll have done a bunch of prep with her. She vanishes with them with a whole wardrobe for like a day. And then they sort of pick out a wardrobe that they like. And then I come in and go, yes, no. Rah, rah. But yeah, it's always like a really fun collaboration doing that kind of stuff. And it's some of the most fun stuff. And again, as someone who was a bit kind of like, oh, 80s, is it all too much? I think at first I was like, well, let's not go too extreme. And then you'd look at pictures of what actually people would be wearing in the 80s. And it was like, well, you know, it's pretty, pretty mad.
Ed's hair.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I know.
It's amazing how something as kind of random as that can just really turn the volume up on his kind of.
It was slightly nerve-wracking, I think, shooting it. I'd be watching rushes and some days I'd be like, this is great. And then other days I'd be like, oh no, was that a good idea? I think it was a good idea. It wasn't, I mean, I can't take credit for it, to be honest. I was kind of messaging with Ed during prep like you do. And he turned up literally, I think I met him once in person to kind of chat. And then the shoot was starting. And so then the next time I met him, he was basically arriving on set. So it was all just messaging in between and kind of like, okay, well, what does this character look like? And unlike Lou and Jackie, his character, I didn't quite know what he should look like beyond we just need to make you look like completely different from however people are familiar with seeing you. And so he was like, oh, maybe we can do something with my hair. And I was like, okay, cool. And then he said, he's like, I know someone, let me try something. Or kind of like, I think he mentioned something about a ponytail and I was picturing like some little subtle ratty thing. And then he sent me this selfie in his bathroom with these like amazing, like thick, luscious extensions in. And I was already shooting like a night shoot with Kristen, I think. And then I just saw this picture. I was like, oh, So I showed it to Kristen and she was like, what the fuck? And then, but then she like got out her phone and looked up a picture of her dad and showed it to me. And her dad's got exactly the same hair.
No. Yeah. Ed's maybe been stalking like her.
Well, that's what she said. So when he first appeared on set, she was kind of like, you've been looking up pictures of my dad. And he's kind of like, he's like, no. And he swears anyway, it's a complete coincidence. You know, I guess maybe if you're bald on top like that, there's only one way to...
It's only going to grow one way, one well, bit. That's yeah. it, basically.
But it did mean actually that then, I mean, it's still a bit hokey, but there's a bit in the film where Kristen's character is kind of like cleaning up the crime scene after they've killed JJ. And there's a brief shot of like an old family photo of Lou and her dad, which we tried doing all this stuff with AI and Photoshop and it didn't really work. And then in the end, I just basically was like, Kristen, do you have any like old family photos of you and your dad? Which she obliged with. And then we like Photoshopped Ed's face on it, which doesn't actually work very well. But still, I'm delighted that it's in the film.
That's amazing. Her faceless dad is in the film.
Yeah, exactly.
That's brilliant. Did you have any like kind of reference points, you know, in terms of, you know, you sometimes hear directors who will kind of either sit and watch some films with some of the cast, or they'll talk about films they want to watch in the lead up to it, not for any sort of specific reason, but more kind of overall
mood.
Yeah, mood, vibe, that kind of thing. Did you have any of those that were?
Yeah, I kind of, I sent them, I think all the cast, like a list of about 8 films, which I've forgotten most of them, but the main ones were like Showgirls, Saturday Night Fever and Crash, the Cronenberg, which maybe seem like quite a disparate sort of set. But I guess because they're all sort of, they all take place in their own, they've all got an element of sort of melodrama and heightened sort ofness.
Yeah, I mean, Saturday Night Fever is actually really fucking dark.
It's horror. It's like really nasty film.
Take the Bee Gees out and
it's... Yeah, exactly. But I think with that one, it was sort of the sort of juxtaposition of the kind of like really gritty darkness. But actually, as the film progresses and the darker it gets, the more sort of dreamy and heady and fantastical the dance numbers get as you sort of go to them. And I don't know, it's just got a real kind of like swagger, I guess. And then Crash, I guess it was sort of like, obviously that just takes place in a completely bananas kind of universe where everyone's just kind of weird and horny the whole time. So it was sort of like, and obviously the kind of like visceral bodiness of it, like, ooh, muscles, metal kind of textures. And then Showgirls, just Showgirls, I guess. But I guess
that
it was
an interesting noise, by the way, from Simon.
I know, like, Vera kept, because I kept mentioning Showgirls when we were writing it, and Vera was like, I really don't think you should keep mentioning Showgirls to people. I was like, I'm fine. But I think it was more like just to, you know, I think to the actors, I was like, don't take any of these literally. It's going to be a different form, but just to sort of like let you know you can take some big swings and it's fine to sort of, that we're not playing this like completely straight and sensible. And I think about Showgirls specifically, it was like the sort of like, I mean, one, I just, you know, I think the whole thing's like a sort of a satire, which I enjoy a lot. But it's, I think the sort of like momentum and energy of it, even if you don't like the film, it's like it's completely undeniable. Just like, it's just completely sort of like fizzy and kind of.
It's like a kind of Barocca in a glass.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Be a Barocca, I said.
What about music-wise in terms of kind of those reference points? Did you have anything that kind of put everybody in the sort of, you know, the sort of ballpark of what you wanted it to sound like, and bringing in, like you talked about, those different elements of the kind of needle drops and that lovely bleed from kind of needle drops into score. Was there any reference?
What, like with the actors
score?
Or like when we were?
Well, just for, in terms of, I guess for how it would sound as well.
Well, I literally got you to do like playlists for the actors, which had a lot of that stuff in it. And then I think we also shared that stuff with like Paul Davies, our sound designer, who, you know, was a big fan of a lot of that kind of music when it first came out. Mm. And, you know, some of it's kind of a bit more kind of industrial, noisy kind of stuff and throbbing whistle, this kind of thing. So he took that as like a bit of a sort of launching off point for some of the sound design as well. And I kind of like music and sound that sort of bleeds a bit in and out of each other. So he, so basically because we had all these playlists and stuff already, tracks, I think in post, it was kind of, I don't think there were specific films necessarily where I was referencing for music. It was kind of like, okay, this is like Lou's music, let's use this as kind of a launching off point in as many directions as we can.
And also that kind of element of sound around the kind of almost hyper realism of, you know, the muscles and the kind of close-up,
yeah,
and all that
kind
of stuff.
Squelchy, crunchy muscles.
Yeah, that's a big part of the film, and it's a big part for us as a sensual experience of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, like our whole sound team is just like incredible. I think we had a particularly brilliant effects editor called Tim, who kind of was I mean, Paul Davies is kind of like, you know, heading all of that, but specifically the guy who was doing the effects, sound effects throughout it was really phenomenal. And I think with all of, I think with a lot of departments, the note was generally like more, bigger kind of thing. Particularly with the sound, it was just, I mean, Paul was the sound designer in St. Maud as well. So again, we'd kind of worked together before. Mm. And he's just great at all this very kind of dark, twisty kind of, I just wanted it all to feel quite visceral and tangible. And it's nice to get a kind of physical,
yeah,
squirmy reaction from people.
with the performance, with Jackie's performance on stage at the competition, in terms of for Katie, what the kind of, I mean, that's her, you know, a world that she knows, you know, in terms of that, I imagine, you know, in terms of she must have performed at quite a few of these types of things, maybe not quite like that, but...
Yeah, more present day, but yeah.
Yeah, but kind of what that was, you know, what the prep was for that. Did you have music on when you were filming that and all that, you know, in terms of what the choices were for that as well? You know, it was the colour box track on that.
Which really, like, colour box is also the name of like our music supervisor's company, so it's like confusing people. But yeah, it's this British band Colour Box. The song's called The Moon Is Blue. Song we picked already in prep, and so that was in the script so that Katie could kind of get really familiar with it. And I kept meaning to kind of like choreograph it properly well in advance and get a choreographer, but inevitably in the end it was like me and Katie in her backyard like the night before, kind of like, okay, fuck, and then you do this and that. But so we knew what that song was, and we had that blasting when, I mean, that was a pretty fun day of shooting. We basically just had to stage a bodybuilding competition, and we had sort of like five cameras going at the same time all on tracks and stuff. And but particularly when we were doing like the guys, we had like a whole playlist going of more kind of like silly, big, more 80s bangers kind of thing. Although actually the track that's playing when you first cut to the guys, there's like the guy down in the canyon. He's like, oh, fuck, there's more. And then it's like, I'm a bad, bad man. That's actually a library track. Like that was one of the things that I think, because when we first went to Simon, music supervisor, with all the music we sort of were hoping to clear, there was a bunch of, you know, there were some gaps basically, and it was sort of like we'd sort of used up a lot of the budget. So he kind of opened my eyes to the wonders of a lot of library music, and a lot of it's really great. And that song's
works
really
a
fun.
Treat.
Works a treat, yeah.
Amazing.
Exactly. Great fun.
We've got time. I love that, straight in. This is so great. We'll come down here first if that's okay.
I thought it was a really good film. Like, I really liked it. And the thing that stood out for me was like the acting. I thought it was so naturalistic. And I was just wondering, obviously it's good casting and great acting, but what you do to get the best out of your actors and how involved you are in the process?
I mean, probably like casting, it's the most important bit, to be honest. And I think once you've done that, then that's sort of half your job done. Well, what do? I don't know. We didn't really have any time to rehearse, to be honest. So it was a lot of it's you're just kind of figuring out on the spot. So I guess hopefully if you've cast the right people who get the script, a big part of it's just kind of trying to make people relaxed and playful when they're there on set. So I've tend to be more of the approach of getting people to sort of try things a million different ways instead of it being like, okay, now, instead of the actors having a sense that they're doing take after take, just constantly getting it wrong until the right thing, and you're constantly trying to improve this one version, be a bit more kind of like, okay, cool, we've got that, now try it like this and then try it like that. So then it becomes a bit more like each take becomes it's less pressure, and each time there'll be I think if each take feels a little bit less precious and a little bit less pressure, then they tend to just surprise you a bit more.
Thank you. There's a gentleman with his hand up there. Hello.
Hi, thanks very much. Barocca and steroids, definitely. I was going to ask about a setting, especially because you've done my head in with the kind of, it could have been Soho or Scotland. Because it looks like that crack in the ground and creepy Ed and gun ranges seemed so write. So I'm just curious about sort of how different it would have been, or how so much of it seemed to fit that location.
Yeah, once, I think it was early, I think by the time we were actually writing full drafts of the script, we'd settled on America. So it's more like in those early kind of treatments. I think it mostly came also from me just being a bit nervous of setting something in America, not being from there. And like Vera, who I wrote it with, is Polish, and neither of us really spent much time there. So feeling a bit unqualified. But the more we developed the story, the more it just seemed to make the most logical sense there. I think it's something to do with the vastness of that kind of landscape. It feels a bit more plausible that you get away with murder and kind of live in these kind of a town having its own, feeling a bit like its own little contained universe, and then just nothing else for miles around. And I don't know, as soon as, and then it immediately started making more sense just with, I think Lou's dad didn't run a gun range until we decided to set it in America. We'd been reading through all these weird ideas when it was in Scotland, like he was going to be a pig farmer or something like this. And then he was going to run a nightclub, and then that kept changing. So America, guns, good, made sense. And and then just Jackie's character, her trajectory just seemed a bit more kind of like, oh, well, in some ways, you know, she's kind of embodying that sort of trope of like the American dream. And then looking at how all the ways that can sort of be a hollow promise and undermine it kind of thing. It just gives you, I think like by putting it in America, it immediately gave you this kind of like framework of like American cinematic tropes that I think audiences are like incredibly familiar with. And I think if you've got that kind of familiarity to sort of set it in, you can kind of get away with then pushing a lot of it a lot weirder in a way. So I don't know, it just made the most sense, I think. It was a bit of a wishy-washy answer. But
I think Giant Jackie would be welcomed in Scotland any day.
I still think the Scottish version would be great, but it was kind of like...
feel free to do that version.
It would be great.
Well, that'd be quite an interesting process, no? Of like redoing...
I was really kind of like quite set in it, and I think probably wouldn't have got quite as much money to make it or something. But it was
bit like to do Love Lies Bleeding, the Scottish version.
Yeah.
Why not?
Sequel.
I've got a question. Sorry, Amy, right in the corner there. Thank you so much.
Hi. That was such a blast to see. I guess my question is a little bit outside of this film. So it's more like when you transition from making short films into feature film, your first feature, how was that in terms of the process? Like, did you first get an agent and then you managed to develop the feature film, or did you first get in touch with production companies and then you got the agent? How was that?
I managed to get an agent after graduating from film school. I went to National Film and Television School with Veronica actually, and sort of did a master's there. You know, I'd done some shorts and stuff before, but it was like my grad film off the back of that, I think, managed to get an agent. And then, I don't know, it was still then a few more years of just kind of like working regular jobs and kind of coming up sort of feature idea on the side kind of thing, and sort of having a few general meetings. But then I think during that time I'd maybe met some people at Film 4 and sort of mentioned this idea to them about this girl who falls in love with God, and they were like, okay, cool, sounds interesting, come back when you've got something. And so it was a gradual process over those years of like teaming up with a producer and then sort of applying to get the film in development with them, made some more shorts. It's all like a very gradual bit by bit thing, but yeah, essentially got an agent first, worked on the idea, got it in development with Film 4, BFI came on board as well, and maybe 4 or 5 years later was doing St. Maud. And then weirdly, once I was actually making it though, it did actually not feel a million miles away from making shorts, just kind of with more money and more support in a way. So I think because I sort of like tried to keep that contained for logistical budget sort of reasons, it's sort of, I don't know, it was nice. It didn't feel like I thought I'd suddenly be like, oh God, I don't know what I'm doing. It's going to look like a short film, a giant short film or a giant student film, which hopefully it doesn't. But to be honest, the leap from shorts to St. Maud was a lot less daunting than the leap from St. Maud to this. Like I sort really? Of, yeah. Like I sort of didn't realize until we were out there prepping it and shooting it. I think probably because I'd been writing it with Veronica and just having a lot of fun doing that, just doing it in our little sort of bubble. I'd be like, what if this happens? What if that happens? Oh, great. And then just sort of like having a real laugh doing it. And then being out there and suddenly going, oh no, like, and or sort of realize, you know, just the amount of the scale of it, I guess, and the amount of characters and set pieces and all that kind of stuff. There are a lot of kind of firsts, which is great and fortunate and exciting to get to do, but definitely quite daunting.
Ed and his hair extensions.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've got time for one last question. If there's, was there someone in the middle here? Did I see? There we go. Perfect. Thank you.
Amazing. Wow. I'm very, very curious about the writing, the development of the love story. I noticed two intimacy coordinators, and you said there were not many rehearsals. I know Kristen Stewart, this is a huge, I mean, she is speaking so much about your work together, and she's taking a stand, and thank you for just portraying such a tender, beautiful story. So I'd love to hear more about the development of the romance.
Well, I guess it was sort of as soon as I'd started working on it with Veronica and we decided it would be a romance, that was always like the spine of it. So even as much as the story started to expand into like this sort of, you know, family melodrama, crime sort of stuff, it was always, that was always kind of hanging around it, fundamentally being the thing about these two people. And I guess we always wanted it to be the kind of love story, which is like almost like an anti-love story. I'm not sure. Or, you know, it's basically definitely not the kind of like wholesome story in which love conquers all and brings out the best in people. We kind of wanted it to be a bit more like looking at one of those relationships, which if anyone who's been in like a sort of toxic or unhealthy relationship, you look back on in hindsight and you're like, how did that, what was it? What happened? What was that? But you know, when you're in the midst of it and when you're in it, it can feel exciting and amazing and all these kinds of things. And it's what I like about films is like, it's not necessarily watching healthy, sensible, well-adjusted people being nice to each other. It's kind of, you know, it's fun to sort of explore all those kind of slightly more twisty power dynamics. So that was sort of the approach we had, I guess. And the intimacy, and sex was always going to be an important part of that. Just, you know, it's in the early days of this very passionate kind of steamy relationship. The two intimacy coordinators was literally a scheduling thing. One of them wasn't available on the day that we were shooting one of those scenes. But I really enjoyed working with them. I'd never done that before. And there is a sex scene in Maud, and I don't think we had an intimacy coordinator. It's kind of become a more recent thing in the last few years for that to be like an automatic sort of crew position, which having now done it, I'm like, absolutely, this is crazy that this wasn't a thing before. It just makes it all a lot more kind of fun and straightforward and just makes everyone a lot more sort of chilled and right, okay, I know exactly what's... By the time you get to set, everybody's already had a lot of separate conversations running through exactly how you're going to shoot each scene, what you are and aren't going to show. So there's none of this kind of self-consciousness of like, ooh, are you okay if we... It's like everyone's just there and relaxed and it's kind of fun.
Thank you so much for being here, ladies and gentlemen. But Rose, thank you so, so much for letting us show your film and for being here to chat to us off the back of it. And happy release a week on Friday as well.
Hooray.
Wonderful,
thanks
Rose
very much.
Glass, ladies
thanks,
and gentlemen.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Have a safe journey home, everybody. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
From The Score to Love Lies Bleeding, that's Family Business by Clint Mansell, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' for our Soundtrackin' Everyman Film Club with Rose Glass. My huge thanks to Rose for taking the time to chat to me in front of an audience, to all the team at Everyman for facilitating, and also the Lionsgate team who were absolutely wonderful just helping us get this together. Love Lies Bleeding is on general release now. Please go and see it and support it at the cinema. You can hear our other live shows at edithbowman.com along with every single other episode of the podcast. Follow us on your socials. We're at Soundtracking UK, and please don't forget our YouTube channel, Soundtracking Extra, where we're about to put a dump up there of quite a few of our previous interviews. Next up, we're really thrilled to share with you the wonderful Anna Calvi, who joins me to discuss her work on a number of series of the TV show Peaky Blinders. And we may well discuss the future film potential. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.